Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Milwaukee, back in the 1960s and 70s, there was a series of high-profile murders believed to have been ordered by the mafia. One of the victims was a guy named Isidore Pogrob. His nickname was Izzy. He weighed more than 300 pounds and managed his bar, called the Brass Rail, from two bar stools. It started out as a jazz joint, but by 1960, it was a strip club. The way the story goes is that one night, a bigwig in organized crime named Frank Balestrieri got a phone call. He was sitting in one of his own bars at the time, and three of his enforcers were with him. When Balestrieri hung up the phone, he didn't say a word. He just drew a finger across his throat. The three guys saw that and quickly left. The next day, Izzy Pogrob's body was found in a ditch. He'd been shot multiple times. This is the kind of power Frank P. Balestrieri is believed to have had in Milwaukee. Over the years, there were many murders that Balestrieri was linked to, although he was never charged in any of them. Louis Fazio, Anthony Biernat, August Maniaci, the attempted murder of Vince Maniaci. The Izzy Pogrob killing was just one of them. Was my cousin's murder another? From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is My Cousin Augie. I'm Mary Spacuzza. Episode 3, Fancy Pants. The first thing you need to know about the Milwaukee Mafia is that a lot of people in positions of power tried very hard to convince the public it didn't exist. There was a longtime police chief in Milwaukee named Harold Breyer. Back in the 70s, he used to say that there was no prosecutable evidence of organized crime in Milwaukee. He believed the police force was so strong and so diligent that it just kind of scared away the criminal element. He said organized crime was really a Chicago problem. Detective Ted Engelbart remembers Chief Breyer talking about that.
I do recall Breyer saying, no, there's no prosecutable evidence of organized crime. And when he was saying that, I'm thinking, I don't know. At that time, I did not investigate organized crime or suspected organized crime. I didn't see it the same way Breyer did, and as many other detectives probably felt the same thing. But he's my boss, and okay, Chief, if that's what you feel, I'm not going to argue with him.
Mary Zahn remembers the controversy, too. She covered the police beat for the Milwaukee Sentinel back then.
So people would always say, Breyer covered for the mob, right? So I knew Harold Breyer very well. I don't think he covered for the mob. I think he was just a very stubborn man. And he would say things, crime is crime. Don't talk to me about organized crime. If there's crime there, we're going to get them and blah, blah, blah. In the context of what that was said by Breyer, it was that all crime is organized. So I'm not going to parse out organized crime. Did he actually understand that there was a mafia? Of course he did. Of course he did. But did he do as much as he could have done? There's a lot of questions there, and he would never really, he's not going to sit down and tell you that.
Regardless of what the police chief said publicly, it was an open secret that the mob was operating in Milwaukee, and the guy running it was Frank Balestrieri. Gary Magnuson was an FBI agent in Milwaukee at the time.
The whole police department, I think, was kind of old school mentality. Didn't think that could exist in their city. There was no proof of it and so on. Even the mayor. They drew a couple of cartoons in the Milwaukee Journal of him standing saying there's no organized crime in Milwaukee, and they had pictures of Balestrieri and everybody else.
When I started reporting Kazanagi's story, I knew right away I would have to find out everything I could about Frank Balestrieri and his relationship with Augie. From what I've heard, he was feared. He was known as a very ruthless person who had a lot of power, but wanted even more. He was from a fairly well-to-do family. His father ran a garbage hauling company. He went to Marquette University here in Milwaukee, and actually went to Marquette University Law School, but he dropped out. Gavin Schmidt has a podcast about organized crime, and he was able to tell me a little bit more about Balestrieri's background.
He was a very firm believer in the idea that the father is the head of the family, and what the father says goes, even if it maybe isn't the right thing. He owned a tavern by the time he was in his early 20s. He owned a hotel not long after. He had no reason to go into organized crime. So I can only explain his pursuit of that for selfishness. That's the only thing I can come up with, is that it wasn't about the money. It was just about the power and feeling that he was somebody important. I don't know that. That's speculation. But that's how it comes across to me, because I don't know why somebody would purposely put themselves out there as the head of organized crime when you could avoid that completely and still live a really fulfilling and profitable life.
Through her reporting, Mary Zahn learned a lot about Balestrieri too.
He was not a nice man by any stretch of the imagination. People said he always dressed very dapperly, but he was cold looking, very cold. And one of the FBI agents said if you shook his hand, it was like shaking a dead fish. He was just that kind of a guy. And I understand he was quite the ladies' man. So who was he? Nobody really liked him, but they feared him.
Frank Gimbel is a well-respected Milwaukee defense attorney. He started his career as a federal prosecutor and became quite familiar with Balestrieri.
He was a pretty well-put-together guy.
He was a guy who was not tall, not heavy. He had very, very eyes that were almost like, spotlights coming from his skull that penetrated everything he looked at. From my point of view, he was extraordinarily well-dressed and well-groomed person. He never had a hair out of place on his head. His suits were immaculately tailored to fit him. And he walked with an air of confidence, although he was a short guy. He had the look of authority. He was not a person who you would have an easy ability to ignore if he chose not to ignore you.
We'll have more after the break.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
After those conversations, I still needed to know more. Luckily, there was quite a bit of news coverage about Balestrieri back in the day. All those newspaper clippings still exist in an archive we reporters affectionately call the morgue. These clips used to be housed in the Journal Sentinel newsroom, but when we moved a few years ago, they got shipped to our printing plant. Producer Bill Schultz and I went there to see what we could find. The archives were tucked away in a corner of the cavernous plant. To paint a picture, imagine a small room. There are hundreds of drawers filled with thousands and thousands of musty envelopes, all precariously stacked on somewhat questionable shelving.
I don't know if that shelf is going to hold up.
Well, and that's the funny thing. That's, I think, where the stuff is.
The B drawers, B for Balestrieri, were stacked so high, the shelves were sagging.
Oh, are you serious?
That's where we gotta go.
Oh my God, look at it. Look, oh, the bees. Look at the bees.
Yeah,
they look.
The bees are
bowing.
They actually looked like they might break.
I'm pulling it out now, but it's holding up this.
Oh no.
They're really like Jenga.
Yeah. Is this it?
Yeah, so the balustrading one.
Oh my God.
I always like looking in the archives. You can tell how important a person is because most of these archives are just like one little note card. And this balustrading stuff is literally like thick envelope.
While digging through the clippings, I noticed something.
Hmm. Interesting. Two undercover FBI agents infiltrated Milwaukee Mafia. Balustrade says he had been aware in summer of 1978 that undercover FBI agent was working in vending machine business on East Side. You know who's supposedly here is Donnie Brasco.
Really?
Yeah, he supposedly was in Milwaukee investigating the Balestrieri's, and that they made it a different city in the movie, but if you read the Donnie Brasco book, it's clearly Milwaukee and Balestrieri and, like, vending machines.
Donnie Brasco was the FBI agent's undercover name. His real name was, well, why don't I let him tell you that himself?
My name is Joseph Pistone. I was FBI agent for 27 years, and I operated in an undercover capacity for 6 years in an undercover case where I infiltrated the New York Mafia and other Mafia families throughout the United States. And the undercover name I operated under was Donnie Brasco.
Shortly before Augie was killed, the FBI sent Joe to Milwaukee. His job was to vouch for another agent and help him infiltrate the Balestrieri crime family.
Frank was known as a ruthless individual. Although he was, I believe, he had some kind of college education, but he was still a ruthless individual, according to my mafia contacts that I was associated with in the Bonanno crime family. He actually controlled everything that happened in Milwaukee, illegally and a lot of times legally. You had to go to Frank Balestrieri to get the okay to operate or do things.
Well, so much for the police chief's claim that there was no organized crime in Milwaukee. Here's Mary Zahn again.
Well, I hate to use a cliche, but it's not unlike The Godfather. I mean, every city in this big city in this country had a mob representative somewhere. And Frank Balestrieri was the mob representative here. And people had to pay respects. Balestrieri controlled Milwaukee to a certain extent, but if Chicago wanted something, Chicago got what they wanted. So he was always, and that always grated him, is my understanding. And he had his hand in all sorts of pockets, police department, City Hall. I mean, there was no place that money can't touch if you have enough of it. So he had his hands in everything. Like I said, if you went to a restaurant or a vending machine and you didn't know anything about the mob, you were still probably providing some income to them.
Based on FBI records, Frank Balestrieri was deeply involved in organized crime by the 1950s and was running the show by the 1960s. As for how he got the top job, he married the boss's daughter. Here's Gary Magnuson again.
Frank Balestrieri was put in as the head. Now, although Milwaukee was a fairly small family, all of the soldiers and so on despised him because he didn't have creds. He was a nobody, really. He had never really shown himself to be a good criminal or anything like that. So they didn't like him.
It wasn't long before Balestrieri's father-in-law became concerned with the way he was running things. Here's Mary reading an excerpt from one of her stories she wrote with fellow reporter Bill Janz. She had the opportunity to listen to tapes of Balestrieri the FBI had recorded.
It was a meeting about bloodshed. Frank P. Balestrieri wanted some. His father-in-law didn't. After Balestrieri threatened to kill at least two men, he shouted at his father-in-law, who pleaded for a more merciful solution. La Mazzari, Balestrieri said in Sicilian, meaning, I gotta kill them. The meeting was in 1964, when once again Balestrieri was upset with August J. Maniaci, a small-time businessman, pizza cook, and sometime associate of Balestrieri. The meeting ended after John Eliotto, the former chief of organized crime here, commented on the business style of Balestrieri, Eliotto's son-in-law and the current head of organized crime. "I don't know why you're so anxious for blood," Eliotto said. At one point, in the midst of shouts, Eliotto said something about dying, and Balestrieri shot back, "You're not going to die, he's going to die." "I don't know why you're so anxious for blood," Eliotto said. "Do it for me, do it for me. I'm your father-in-law. You married my daughter, your kids are my grandchildren. Do something for me, show you care."
But according to Joe Pistone, that's not what Balestrieri did.
Story I got is Frank pushed him out. I mean, he pushed his father-in-law out. I don't know how, but to become boss, that was his goal, to be the boss, and he got rid of his father-in-law.
Balestrieri always had a huge presence in downtown Milwaukee. Here's Gavin Schmidt again.
Frank Balestrieri had a number of businesses over the course of his career. In his early days, it was taverns, it was hotels, specifically the Hotel Roosevelt, which got torn down as part of the city's redevelopment. He spread out into other taverns and nightclubs, which is probably what he's best known for today. He had a number. I mean, Gallagher's, the Tower, the Ad Lib. I mean, it goes on and on. He's generally seen as having the Shorecrest Hotel and the Snugs restaurant that was inside of it. That's debatable because the Shorecrest was in his son's name. So officially it was Joe's hotel. But yeah, then he went on into other business ventures. Vending machines is probably the one that he's most known for outside of the nightclubs.
Balestrieri was also known as a key figure in a scheme to skim millions from Las Vegas casinos in the 1970s. You might be familiar with it from the movie Casino. Gary Magnuson worked on the case. He said the scheme began when Balestrieri and his sons were introduced to a realtor named Alan Glick. Glick had a lucrative plan to buy several Las Vegas casinos. All he needed was someone to front the money. And Balestrieri had some connections with the Teamsters Pension Fund.
So he flew out to Milwaukee and met with Frank Balestrieri. We get this from Alan Glick's testimony later on. And he met with the two sons, who introduced themselves as attorneys and so on. He was told that they could get a Teamsters pension fund loan if he would agree to something. Now, what he had to agree to was they were, and there was an actual legal document agreement written up where he agreed to sell half of Argent, which was his company that had four casinos, and they would be able to buy that half portion for $25,000. Now, he got the loan for $64 million to buy those casinos. And so their plan was they were going to become casino owners, legitimate. But, of course, it wasn't legitimate because they forced their way into it. And that was their big hope. That was what they wanted to do.
It wasn't long before other mafia bosses got wind of the deal. Frank Savella, the boss in Kansas City, and Joe Iuppa, the boss in Chicago, demanded a sit-down.
And Iuppa told Frank Balestrieri, "This is the way it's going to be. The money will come to me. We will run the casinos, and you'll get a piece. No longer, you're not going to be the guy anymore. You'll get a piece of it. Chicago will get a piece, Kansas City will get a piece, and Cleveland will get a piece." And the reason for that was each of those families had their hooks into men that sat on the Teamsters loan board.
They probably weren't very happy to hear of Frank Balestrieri's sweet deal that he had worked out without them, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. And he was actually threatened. He says, "This is the way you're going to be, or you ain't going to be around anymore."
More after the break.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Balistrieri had his hands in gambling back in Milwaukee, too. As you'll recall from the previous episode, Augie was also heavily involved in gambling. Could this have been one of the reasons Augie was killed? Anyhow, let's get back to Balistrieri. As Balistrieri built his empire, he drew the attention of the FBI. Taking a page out of the playbook that brought down Al Capone decades earlier, the feds went after Balistrieri in the 1960s for tax evasion. Frank Gimble prosecuted the tax fraud case against Balistrieri. Because of all the publicity surrounding the case in Milwaukee, the trial was moved to Illinois. Gimble met with other prosecutors for dinner down in Peoria when something very strange happened.
And we were eating in a restaurant when the maitre d' of the restaurant came to our table and asked whether or not there was a person at the table by the name of Frank Gimble. I said, "I'm Frank Gimble. I have a telephone call for you." I said, "Okay." I had no idea who possibly could have known that I was in this restaurant or I was in Peoria, Illinois on a Friday night. I went to the phone. I picked up the phone, and the voice on the other end said, "Is this Frank Gimble?" I said, "It is." He says, "Well, my name is Mitch Ragovan. I am the Assistant Attorney General of the United States in charge of the Tax Division. And I know that you're on your way to Springfield, Illinois, to begin the Balistrieri case on Monday morning. By this telephone call, I'm asking you to seek an adjournment of the beginning of the trial." I said, "What? What possible reason would I advance to the judge?" He said, "I can't tell you that."
Gimble tells the guy there's no way he can ask to delay the trial without a reason. So the guy on the phone said he would call back the next day. Frank walks back to the table, and one of the people he was having dinner with asks about the call.
I said, "You're just not going to believe this conversation." And I fainted.
Oh, really?
Honest to God, this is a true story. I fell down. You know, here I am, this lawyer who is 30 years old, and this is a huge case. And I now feel like I have lost control of whatever preparation I had to go ahead with this trial. But nonetheless, the fire department came. They wanted to take me away. And I recovered and I said, no, I'm fine. Goodbye. Get out of here.
As promised, the assistant attorney general called him back.
On Saturday, before the trial was to begin, I got a call from Mr. Ragovan. And the conversation went something like this. "Hey, Frank, listen, I'm sorry about my conversation yesterday, but I'm going to tell you the story. On Thursday or Friday of this past week, Mr. Balistrieri was moving from his office in Milwaukee. And among the things that he did is he took some wood paneling down from the office and he found a microphone. And he also found that the microphone was connected by wire from the building where his office was to a telephone pole some a block and a half away."
The microphone turned out to be an illegal wiretap that had been put there by the FBI. And Balistrieri's lawyer wanted the whole case thrown out because of it. Luckily for the government, the judge refused to do that. Balistrieri reported an income of something like $12,000 on his tax return, but prosecutors were able to show that he'd spent more than $20,000. And you can't spend more than you make.
And the jury came back with a guilty verdict against Balistrieri. And he was sentenced to 2 years in prison, as I recall.
After serving time for tax evasion, Balistrieri got out of prison in 1972. But the FBI wasn't done with him yet. Years later, they decided to go the undercover route and also planted legal wiretaps. We'll talk about the wiretaps in a later episode. Joe goes on to tell a story about the time Frank Balestrieri took him to a fundraiser unannounced.
We also went to an affair which was called the Icebreaker, and he hadn't made reservations to attend this big affair in Milwaukee, but he decided to go, and he said, just to shake them up. And when we walked in this ballroom, it had to be a couple hundred people, everything just stopped when they saw him. The maitre d' came over and said, "Oh, you know, Mr. Balestrieri, I didn't know you were coming." They cleared out an area, set a table up for us, and it was like, you know, if you were in a foreign country, a president walking in, or the queen walking in. I mean, you could see that everybody knew who he was, and either they were terribly afraid of him or respected him. But he was the man. He was the man in Milwaukee. Yep.
There's no question Balestrieri was feared, but being feared isn't the same as being respected. Here's Gary Magnuson again.
Balestrieri didn't have a great reputation. They referred to him behind his back as Fancy Pants, because he always was well-dressed, always wore expensive suits and stuff like that. And so you had this below-the-surface turmoil boiling within the crew, within those that were associated with the organized crime group. And Balestrieri knew it, and he didn't like it. So in 1975, I believe it was, he put more and more pressure on these people to kind of fall into line and stop what they were doing and pay him as the boss. He'd get a certain percentage, you know, from the various illegal activities.
But Augie didn't fall in line. In fact, people who knew him told me Augie didn't take crap from anybody. And the more I learned, the more it seemed like there was bad blood between him and Balestrieri for years. Here's Joe Pistone again.
I'm sure that his business dealings, you know, that's where he probably ran afoul of Balestrieri, you know. I would say, you know, jealousy moved in, you know. Frank, you know, seeing a guy making money, doing what he was doing, and maybe wanted a piece of the action. I don't know. But if I had to take a guess, that might have been one of the beefs that they had.
Gary Magnuson believes it could have been some combination of the two. Augie disrespecting Balestrieri and also refusing to give him a cut of the gambling proceeds.
Augie Palmisano, although he was not a made member, he didn't like him at all either and would talk about him on the street. Frank Balestrieri, through his enforcer, put pressure on Palmisano to pay a percentage of his winnings to Frank Balestrieri, or else. Okay, Steve DeSalvo was the enforcer. He was observed by another agent in a big argument out on the street with Augie Palmisano.
But no one knows for sure what the fight was about. John Franke, who prosecuted Balestrieri in the 80s, believes it didn't take much to anger him.
If someone was arrogant to him, insulted him in any public way, even if there were no other issues, it wouldn't take, you know, a long-standing feud or other things. Maybe those contributed to it, maybe not, but public disrespect might have been enough to teach a lesson, to send a message.
It wasn't long before someone decided to send one of those messages, this time to Augie's best friend. Next time on My Cousin Augie.
The accelerator wouldn't make the car go any faster than like 20 miles an hour. And he couldn't figure out what the problem was. So he stopped, pulled off the side of the road, opened the hood, and almost had a heart attack because there was a big roll, 26 of dynamite wrapped in duct tape.
My Cousin Augie is written and produced by me, Mary Spacuzza. Executive producers are Bill Schultz and Gina Barton. Our editor is Daphne Chen. Sound engineer is Bill Schultz. Andrea Brunty is our graphic designer. Executive editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is Greg Borowski. I also want to thank Tom Ketting, Carrie Spivak, Burford Gammon, Carl Ebert, Sarah Volpenheim, Ricardo Torres, Frankie Simmons, and Dan Simmons for their help with this podcast. For more stories about Donnie Brasco, listen to the Deep Cover podcast with Joe Pistone and Leo Rossi, or pick up Joe's book, Donnie Brasco, My Undercover Life in the Mafia. If you are interested in more stories about the FBI's investigation into organized crime in Milwaukee and Las Vegas, you can check out Gary Magnuson's book, Straw Men. For more information about the Milwaukee Mafia, listen to Gavin Schmidt's podcast or pick up one of his books. My stories about Cousin Augie, along with photos, can be found on our website at jsonline.com/mycousinaugie.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.